targeting the Ayatollah today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. The Trump administration put more economic pressure on Iran today, including sanctions specifically on their supreme leader. And don't tell the White House those new measures are just for show.
For people who say these are just symbolic, that's not the case at all. We've literally locked up tens and tens of billions of dollars. So no, these sanctions are highly effective.
Plus, how the U.S. and Iran are targeting each other with cyber attacks. And later, ecological grief, what many of us feel as we witness changes to our planet.
We know there's climate change, weather shifts, things that impact us on a daily basis, but also things that are going to impact our planet and the health and well-being of many species moving forward.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. Three days after he called off a military strike on Iran, President Trump today announced new economic sanctions against the Islamic Republic and its leaders.
These measures represent a strong and proportionate response to Iran's increasingly provocative actions. We will continue to increase pressure on Tehran until the regime abandons its dangerous activities and aspirations, including the pursuit of nuclear weapons, increased enrichment of uranium, development of ballistic missiles, engagement in and support for terrorism, fueling of foreign conflicts, and belligerent acts directed against the United States and its allies.
Speaking to reporters at the White House, Trump described the new sanctions as hard-hitting, but was short on details. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin tried filling in the blanks.
For people who say these are just symbolic, that's not the case at all. We've literally locked up tens and tens of billions of dollars. These sanctions will come along with additional entities where people are hiding money. So, no, these sanctions are highly effective.
John Hughes served as deputy director of the Office of Sanctions Policy and Implementation at the State Department under President Obama. John, what are these new sanctions against Iran all about?
Yeah, no, thanks, Marco. So I think that these sanctions really are more bark than bite. I mean, so really what they did today was that they designated the supreme leader of Iran as well as his office. And then allowed for additional designations of people that he has appointed to senior officials within the Iranian government.
Yeah, so when the president describes these new sanctions as hard-hitting, as to the content of them, would you agree with that?
No, I wouldn't. I mean, listen, Marco, so it is true that sanctions are biting against Iran. If you look at what the Trump administration has done since they pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal, they've essentially reimposed all the sanctions that were in place before then. They've already targeted sort of upwards of 90% of all of Iran's export revenues and, you know, made people no longer import oil, et cetera. So everything that they do at this point is really just sort of on the margins, and certainly going after the supreme leader's assets, I don't think it's going to have much of an impact. It's unlikely that he's doing much business with any major international banks anyway.
But they do signal, at least publicly, that the campaign of maximum pressure continues against Iran. So what is the goal, do you think, of all these sanctions and this maximum pressure on Iran? Like, what does the U.S. want from Iran now in 2019?
Well, you know, the Trump administration, I think, has tried to make it clear, and I think they said it again today, that they want Iran to come back to the table to negotiate what they think is a better deal. I think the problem is that they are pretty unrealistic in their terms, right? If you look at sort of the 12 things that Secretary Pompeo laid out and then what Trump sort of alluded to today in his comments, I mean, these amount to essentially full-on regime change in Iran. It's nothing that the Iranian leadership would ever accept. The other problem is that, you know, their campaign really is maximum pressure without any diplomacy. And it's hard to have any progress without having both of those things.
John, what's your best guess about what's going to happen next?
My best guess is that you'll probably see some more of this brinksmanship between both sides. I think Iran likely will look to lash out somewhere in the region, maybe military, maybe elsewhere, somewhere to show that it can send a message. You know, that is unfortunate. But like I said, I think that it is somewhat of a possible outcome. And then on the other side, the U.S., again, I don't think that they have a strategy beyond just increasing sanctions. I don't think that there is much that they can increase there. So they will continue to say that they're increasing sanctions, but really these aren't all that effective.
John, as someone who is part of the Iranian sanctions protocol in Washington, how do you get your own head around this brinksmanship under Trump when it's not at all clear what the U.S. wants out of it aside from a better deal or regime change?
Yeah, it's hard to get my mind around it, Marco. I mean, when I was doing this, it was always sort of the implicit bargain that it was true that we were increasing sanctions, and we were doing that, I think, fairly effectively. But at the same time, we also had international buy-in from the entire international community. And most importantly, we had a negotiating process with Iran at the same time. So it was sort of a carrot and stick approach. As soon as you take away those carrots and all you have is a stick, then I really don't know how you can make progress. And I should say also that if sanctions are your only tool, then you're not really going to have an effective policy. They really just need to be part of your toolbox. And that does not seem to be the case here.
John Hughes was point man on sanctions at the State Department under President Obama. John, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
So sanctions are increased, the military is on alert, and there's another arena where the conflict with Iran is playing out, cyberspace. John Holdquist is the director of intelligence analysis with the cybersecurity company FireEye. He's been tracking the current cyber standoff between the U.S. and Iran. He joins us from Reston, Virginia. The U.S. says it launched a cyber attack on Iran on Thursday. Iran's telecommunications minister says that attempt was not successful. So what are you able to confirm has, in fact, transpired between Iran and the U.S. in the last 5 days?
Well, we haven't been able to actually confirm any attack from the United States. However, we have been watching Iranian threat actors who we've been tracking for quite some time. And they have been carrying out what we call spear phishing attacks against our customers throughout the United States public and private sector.
I mean, the fact that you have not been able to confirm anything and the fact that Iran's telecommunications minister says an attempt was not successful, what does that tell us? That something did happen?
It's a pretty murky space. It's difficult from our vantage point to really confirm that type of activity. You can expect it'll be very sophisticated and won't leave a lot of traces behind.
I mean, according to multiple reports, the U.S. and Iran have been conducting this shadow cyber war for years now. What has changed in the past few weeks?
As tensions sort of grow, we can expect both sides, or at least the Iranian side, to make better use of this capability. They are developing this program to carry out cyber espionage. They use spear phishing attacks to gain access to computer systems belonging to government officials in order to reduce uncertainty about what's going on. But the other side of the coin is we've seen Iranian actors use their capabilities for cyber attack. Typically, they go after the private sector. These aren't extremely complex attacks, but they will bring an organization to a halt. What we see them do typically is use something called a wiper, which is a destructive attack where hard drives are literally wiped clean and business can come to a stop.
Tell me about spear phishing. What does that mean?
Well, this is essentially them sending emails with links or attachments to get somebody to open them and basically download malware onto their system, which would then give them access to a system which they can then use to move across the network and compromise several other machines.
Yeah, so if this conflict between the U.S. and Iran continues to escalate, what can Iran do in the cyberspace? What kind of targets would Iran go after here?
If they chose to go after targets in the United States, they would go after non-military targets where they enjoy an asymmetric advantage. We've seen this before. We've seen them go after oil and gas. We've seen them go after the financial sector. They may go after U.S. interests in the Gulf region indirectly by targeting U.S. firms that do business there. So there are a lot of options for them, and they have a lot of experience doing this.
I mean, U.S. citizens, it would seem, would be deeply affected if Iran cyber attacks went after oil and gas. Are there other ways regular U.S. citizens might be affected by an Iranian cyber attack?
I think typically this is an economic attack. This is about causing economic disruption to companies and production. Typically, we're talking about systems that are used for email and scheduling and things of that nature. But when countries don't want to escalate things to armed conflict, it allows them to send signals and cause some harm, but limited harm. In a lot of ways, this is very similar to the maritime sabotage that we're also seeing. It's a tool that the Iranians can use without necessarily escalating the conflict to a point that would be beyond their control.
John Holdquist, the director of intelligence analysis with the cybersecurity company FireEye. He's been tracking the current cyber standoff between the U.S. and Iran. John, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
We've been hearing a lot recently about climate pollution from air travel, but airlines produce more than greenhouse gas waste. If you fly a lot, you know what I'm talking about. All the single-use plastic cups, meal boxes, water bottles, pretzel bags. Is it all really necessary? Qantas Airways in Australia is also asking that question. Here's the world's Jason Margolis with the latest in our series on waste.
Please place any larger bags in the overhead lockers, smaller bags under the...
This spring, passengers on a Wednesday morning flight from Sydney to Adelaide were greeted in the usual way. But then the flight attendant tacked on something unexpected.
At this time, we'd like to invite you to sit back and enjoy the world's first zero-waste flight. We certainly hope you're as proud as we are to be part of aviation history.
Aviation history? The world's first zero-waste flight?
And that means that all plastic, paper, aluminium and food items that we'll be serving you today will be either composted, recycled or reused.
Andrew Parker with Qantas was on that first zero-waste flight.
And this flight was the first, I guess you could call, laboratory. There were 1,000 individual items that we removed or substituted from this flight.
Everything from plastic stirrers to individualized salt and pepper containers. Altogether, Qantas's goal is to eliminate 100 million pieces of single-use plastic annually by the end of next year. That's 45 million plastic cups, 30 million sets of cutlery, 21 million coffee cups, and 4 million headrest covers. Qantas is also experimenting with new types of packaging, meal containers from sugarcane and silverware from cornstarch. The airline is also redesigning its entire approach to cleaning up.
The design of things like the galley carts that you see go up and down the aisles.
New carts allow flight attendants to separate compost from recycling from lingering fragments of trash brought on board by passengers. For an airline to pull off a near-zero-waste flight, the redesign also has to go well beyond what happens in the sky.
Then you've got to have the systems in place to get the waste off the flight at the end.
Susan Selke is the director of the School of Packaging at Michigan State University. She says composting, for example, has to get directed to an anaerobic digestion system on the ground.
And if you're talking about an airline that's going to be landing in places all over the world, you have to have these systems in place everywhere that the plane is going to offload the waste.
That's why Qantas is taking things slowly and has flown just one test flight to one location. Still, Michael Hiscox is confident Qantas can pull it all together.
These guys fly immensely complex machines around the world in all sorts of...
Separating composting from recycling, not a big challenge for an airline, he says. Hiscox studies sustainability issues at Harvard University. He's also working with Qantas on getting greener. And he says the biggest challenge to achieving its zero-waste goals is mostly beyond the company's control, finding suppliers to meet its demand.
And for some of this, you know, niche-y, compostable, bioplastic stuff, there's not a big supplier base out there at the moment. So
but if other airlines follow Qantas's lead, that could help drive a market for things like niche bioplastics. Hiscox believes other airlines will follow, as airline competitors tend to do, with a big caveat.
If there's strong consumer support.
And there were some small inconveniences on that one flight, like slightly slower service as flight attendants figured out the new systems.
And so I'm sure some customers complained or grumbled, like, where's my single serving milk? And Qantas basically had to explain, you know, we want to get to zero waste. We think you support this. So we all have to adjust.
The airline says it will try another zero waste test flight later in the year with the ultimate goal of reducing 75% of its onboard waste. Of course, one of the biggest environmental impacts of flying may not be things like plastic straws. It's all that carbon dioxide from burning all that jet fuel. And that is a separate, far more complicated challenge. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. President Trump has delayed the mass deportations he had threatened would start this week. They were to target undocumented people who already had deportation orders or had missed court dates. And they were also to focus on families. The president said the deportations would now be postponed for 2 weeks. But people in several major cities are still bracing for the deportations, including in Houston. Cesar Espinoza is head of FIEL, the largest immigrant rights group in Houston. FIEL has been fielding hundreds of calls and running workshops for people at risk of deportation. Cesar, the president has delayed this, but are you still bracing for raids and deportations at some point?
The president's tweets have exacerbated the concern and anxiety. People are calling or flooding our office with calls. They're flooding our inboxes. But at the same time, we have retrained staff that's talking to folks. And we want folks to know that they should craft an action plan and call their friends and family members to be there for them in case any of this does happen. The other thing that unfortunately we were also receiving is false reports of raids happening. So we have deployed a rapid response team all over the city of Houston and the greater Houston area that will go out and verify these reports, because unfortunately with social media, some of these things can go viral and can cause more panic.
But it sounds like you are still bracing for the possibility of raids and subsequent deportations.
We are, because of the fact, too, that the president in his tweet said that he was going to give Congress 2 weeks to act to fix asylum laws and things like that. And unfortunately, we have also lost faith in Congress to enact anything because of the partisanship issues that exist. So therefore, we know that in 2 weeks, something else is going to come back and our community and ourselves have to be ready to respond to anything that we need to do.
If ICE were to show up at someone's home or place of work, what are you recommending people do?
We are recommending that people, number one, is that people do not open the door if immigration comes to their house. They have the right to have immigration or ICE present a judicial warrant as well as an ICE warrant and make sure that they're both signed by judges. So then that way they can see that these orders are real and that they are really looking for that person. Number two is we're asking folks to remain silent. Anything that they can say at that time can and will be used against them in immigration court. So we ask people to just say in a very firm voice, under the Fifth Amendment, I have the right to remain silent and I'm choosing to exercise that right. Number three is that they do not sign any documents pertaining to any deportation or anything really. Number one, because a lot of these documents can contain very difficult legal language to understand. And number two, it could be in a language that folks don't necessarily feel comfortable in reading or speaking. It's also important that they record these interactions because we also want to make sure that we hold ICE accountable if they are overstepping their boundaries or if they're doing things that they're not supposed to, if they're questioning other people in the home. And number five, it's important that even before all of this happens, that people get educated, that people get organized, and that people know that we have to be there for one another.
So individuals have the right to record their interactions with ICE or any immigration officials?
They do have the right to record these interactions, yes.
Has the delay in the deportation action changed the advice that you're giving to people?
The advice does not change. We want to make sure that we take this not as an opportunity to hide in fear, but rather as an opportunity to show that we're resilient and that we're going to turn a very bad situation, as we normally do, into a very positive situation to where we can get our community prepared. We've been very bold in letting people know that we are also undocumented, that I'm also undocumented, so that other people can know that if I don't back down, then they shouldn't back down either. And we need to assert our dignity and our rights as human beings and our ability to be here and be here to stay.
Cesar Espinoza, the head of FIEL, the largest immigrant rights group in Houston. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
This month in Mozambique, the U.S. laid out its plans to significantly increase business investment in low and middle income countries across Africa. The project doubles down on the idea that U.S. relationships with African countries should be based in trade, not aid, as the phrase goes. But it's also an attempt to counter the rapidly growing influence of China on the continent. My colleague Carol Hill spoke with Aubrey Ruby of the Atlantic Council's Africa Center about why the U.S. is investing more than ever in Africa.
Aubrey, China has been investing heavily in Africa for years. Is this new approach by the Trump administration a way of playing catch-up?
Well, China historically has done a lot of what I would call infrastructure financing. They are giving government-to-government loans. So in Kenya, the government of Kenya borrowed from China to construct a railway, and then Chinese companies built the railway. The U.S. takes a very different approach, which is to invest in companies directly or in projects directly, but they don't give the government-to-government loan in the same way. And they have different sectors of competitive advantage. The Chinese are very good at construction. 7 of the top 10 construction companies in the world are Chinese, whereas the U.S. economy is based on services, financial sector, technology, entertainment sector. These are areas that the U.S. excels in.
But despite their divergent approaches, is investing in Africa through this new initiative a way to counter Chinese influence there?
Yes, it's an approach to ramp up the U.S. economic engagement with African markets. The view is that maybe we've been neglecting emerging markets and African markets in particular for too long, and that the Chinese have kind of stepped in. And so this is a way to try to amp up what the U.S. has done historically.
It seems like a bit of a shift for the Trump administration. President Trump had famously referred to low-income countries, many of which are in Africa, in less than flattering terms. What's his interest now in Africa?
Yes, it's been a marked shift from the beginning of the Trump administration, because not only were those comments made, but his first budget proposal did not even include the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. So this whole agency was supposed to be zeroed out. And now, instead of being zeroed out, it went from $29 billion to $60 billion. So it's a night and day difference from the beginning. And I think it all comes down to a settling in, an ossification of the worldview in Washington, that is that the U.S. is competing with China. And in order to compete with China, there needs to be more tools.
From your point of view, what are the likely countries in Africa to attract investment by the U.S.?
Well, I think there's a lot of research that shows that U.S. companies and their counterparts in Europe tend to invest in countries that have better rule of law and better business regulations, and then the larger markets. So, of course, there's a lot of interest in Kenya, in Ethiopia, in Nigeria, of course, because of its size, but also Ghana. Ghana is a favorite of U.S. companies.
And what's been the feedback from African countries? Are they in principle interested?
Yes. I mean, African countries are interested in investment from all over the world. You know, the challenge of job creation across African markets is so enormous that they need investment from everywhere. And even the Chinese only cover 20% of Africa's infrastructure needs. So they need investment from everywhere. And I think most countries are welcoming the greater interest from the U.S.
Aubrey Ruby, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Aubrey Ruby is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Africa Center, speaking there with the world's Carol Hills. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, endangered rhinos are flown from the Czech Republic to Rwanda in an effort to help their species survive in the wild.
It's really a huge undertaking by the European Association of Zoos and Aquariums, and we hope it can be the example of many.
That story still ahead here on The World. Residents in the Indian city of Chennai had to buy water that got trucked in this month after the city nearly ran out. In southern New Jersey, residents are facing the opposite problem as they clean up after massive floods. The forces of nature have always created risks, but climate change is increasing those risks, and fast. We're in for more dangerous heat, drought, and wildfires, more flooding, heavy downpours, and infrastructure damage. The world's Carolyn Beeler was just on a two-month expedition to Antarctica with scientists researching climate change. And along the way, she spoke with one of the ship's staffers about risk and how to manage it.
Here, I just wanted to do a quick weather check. Where I am right
Joey now. Patterson's job as marine technician is to deal with whatever Antarctica can throw at her. Today, she's in a small boat near a little rocky island just offshore of West Antarctica. And what it throws at her is a 1,500-pound elephant seal looking at her inflatable boat like it's lunch.
He started eyeballing the pontoons on the Zodiac, and he kind of, like, opened his mouth like he was going to put his mouth on it.
Joey grew up in Alaska, where she learned to stand her ground with big wild animals.
And so those instincts kicked in, and I was just like, no, don't bite my boat.
This is just one of the 1,000 work-related risks Joey takes on every day, big and small. She runs small boats and heavy science equipment on the Nathaniel B. Palmer Research Vessel here in West Antarctica. It's dangerous, physical work in a place where falling overboard could kill you in a matter of minutes. So Joey's a stickler for safety. One day, she guides a big metal scientific instrument off the deck of the ship into the water below. It's a super calm day, but she still tethers herself to the ship.
We've had waves that will come through the door and like break over my head. And you could definitely lose your feet.
2 weeks into the two-month science expedition, we're all reminded of why these safety precautions are necessary.
We have to medevac somebody.
The ship's chief scientist, Rob Larder, announces we're turning around for a medical emergency. We're headed to the nearest research base on the Antarctic Peninsula.
Because they have a hard airstrip and an aircraft that can go from there to South America. So that is the quickest way of getting somebody back to proper medical care.
The quickest way is still 1,000 miles and 4 days away. When we arrive offshore of the science base, Joey helps get the sick crew member over the side of our ship into a small boat that ferries her to land. To me, this is a powerful reminder of just how remote and vulnerable we are. But for Joey,
knowing in the back of your mind we're 4 days away from a doctor, that is like a driving force behind all of the little meticulous things that we do.
Joey's on her 9th trip to Antarctica, and she's comfortable with the risks she assumes to be here, partly because she has some control over her safety. But this job is bringing her face to face with a different kind of risk. Risks stemming from climate change.
And with climate change, it's a different feeling because you don't get a choice in entering that situation.
She tells me about growing up in Alaska and watching a glacier shrink before her very eyes.
On a very deep, like, personal level, it's very painful to see that. And those problems just seem so exponential. I don't even know how to begin protecting myself and my life and my livelihoods from what is already starting to happen.
A month into our trip, we finally arrive at our destination and come face to face with another disappearing glacier, a huge one, Thwaites Glacier. It's melting fast and could one day trigger up to 11 feet of sea level rise. When we get there, it's a somber day, but also an exciting one. No one's ever been where we are before. Joey's up on the fifth deck catwalk with a few scientists. The edge of the glacier slumps down to the water like a sledding hill and has these erratic peaks poking up. It does not look like a sheer cliff of ice like a healthy glacier would.
Test 1, 2.
Okay.
We're sailing so close, Joey suggests we try bouncing our voices off the face of the glacier.
Whoop!
I don't know, did you hear it?
I heard it.
Joey said this was a thrilling moment, but also a weird one, like staring climate change in the face.
I kind of felt sick, like my stomach got kind of quivery, because it's a very dramatic encapsulation of the chaos that's being experienced all over the planet right now with bigger storms and crazy temperatures. And to see this glacier that you know should have a geometric front all kind of slumped over and erratic just really sent that home.
Joey and ecologist Guy Bortoloto are struck by chunks of ice that look fragile enough to blow away.
That little block right there, that is just like sitting there perched perfectly. Like, who knows how long it'll stay there.
That tiny part looks like it's gonna fall at any second.
Yeah.
This one too. That one too.
Joey lives in Maine now, in a house she's renovating with her husband. It's 6 miles from the coast, but the area still floods sometimes during storms.
And I've seen it. I've seen water like roll into parking lots and things like that in the towns near where I live.
She wonders what'll happen as Thwaites Glacier melts and pushes up sea levels around the world.
It makes me think about protecting the things that I have, which I don't have very much, but what I do have is important to me, and kind of putting it in a place where the ocean, which is a giant, scary, and merciless thing, can't get to it.
The risks we face from climate change may be big and hard to wrap our heads around, but we have no choice but to get better at planning for them. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
All of Carolyn's reporting and photographs from Antarctica are online at theworld.org. Dealing with and protecting ourselves from the impacts of climate change can be an emotional struggle as much as anything else. That's a problem that public health workers are seeing more and more of. Ashley Consolo is one of them. She's a health geographer and researcher at Memorial University in Labrador in Canada. She spoke about this with my colleague, Carol Hills.
Ashley, we've just heard Joey Patterson express that she's struggling to deal emotionally with what she calls the chaos that's being experienced all over the planet right now. You have a term for that. You call it ecological grief. What do you mean by that?
So ecological grief is the grief or the pain or the sadness or suffering that people identify as experiencing when they lose a beloved ecosystem or species or place. So it's grief that situates us within the environment and within the ecosystems in which we live and which we need for our overall health, our wellness, our cultural identities, and our overall mental health.
How is ecological grief expressed?
There's a whole variety of ways that people experience it. So some are from acute impacts. So when we're thinking about major events like forest fires or flooding or major storms and hurricanes, the immediate grief that people feel or the immediate fear or anxiety that they're experiencing when they're at the front lines of these changes. It's also the grief that then comes after. So the sense of loss, the sense of fear, the ongoing impacts to mental health that come from these large events or these rapid events. There's also grief that comes from slow and creeping changes. So people that are seeing shifts in environments and ecosystems over months or years or decades and feeling that ongoing sense of pain and suffering of watching a beloved place change.
How does ecological grief differ from other types of grief?
Well, ecological grief is a very different form of grieving in some ways because many people have described it as a grief without end. So right now we're living in such a, as your previous person discussed, this chaotic world of loss. Some people have identified it as the sixth mass extinction. We know there's climate change, weather shifts, things that impact us on a daily basis, but also things that are going to impact our planet and the health and well-being of many species moving forward. In some ways, it's very similar to other forms of grief because it can be very isolating, it can be very debilitating, but simultaneously, it can also be something where we find comfort in others and in community. Another important difference about ecological grief is we don't have rituals to celebrate passing or death of more than humans in the same way that we do with humans.
Like funerals and other kinds of things.
Yeah, we don't have those similar sort of moments where we mark a loss or a passing and where community often comes together to support the people who have lost.
Where have you witnessed ecological grief and how is it exactly affecting people's mental health?
I began over 10 years ago to work with Inuit in the Nunatsiavut region of northern Labrador. And in this region, Inuit have been experiencing loss of sea ice, shifts in species, rapidly warming temperatures, changing access to places that are really important for spiritual and cultural reasons. And all of this has led to a rapid shift in culture, in livelihoods, and people's overall mental health. So one of the things that people would discuss is the pain and grief that they were feeling from the loss. And then also a loss of really mourning what it means for future generations.
You know, as you know, mental health is pretty complicated. A lot of people are already prone to depression or anxiety or fear or have specific life circumstances that can tip them toward these things. So how do you know what you're calling ecological grief is a real thing, that it's really these environmental disruptions that are affecting people's mental health?
Yeah, this is a great question, and it's actually one of the most pressing questions in the field right now. One of the ways that we identify it is through people's own self-reporting with experience. So sometimes people who have already present mental health challenges or who know they're susceptible to particular things will be able to identify to say, you know, these shifts in climate or this environmental loss that I experienced actually magnified my other experiences with mental health. Other people have been able to say, you know, I've never experienced this sense of ongoing pain or loss before. I've never felt so much anxiety about the change in the future. So a lot of it is from people self-reporting. Other pieces that we know are through more quantitative epidemiological studies that are happening around the world, where people are actually linking things like increase in mental health clinic visits to changes in temperature or increases in suicide rates at the population level per half degree or degree temperature increases. So there's lots of different ways that research is trying to, you know, tease these things out because, as you said, it's so complex. And oftentimes what we hear with things like ecological grief is sometimes people don't know what's affecting them. So they feel a number of different things. They have some strong emotions, but they're not really able to put sort of a, an idea or a term to it. And sometimes when they hear about ecological grief, they can start to think about, you know, are there environmental things that are impacting me? Now, for some people, that's much more clear because they're at the front lines or they've experienced something like we discussed previously around wildfires or floods and are very acutely in the trauma moment. For other people, with those creeping and slow and gradual changes, or even just the knowledge of knowing how things are changing around the world, that's sometimes harder to tease out and harder to figure out about how it's actually impacting your daily lives, your overall sense of self, and your overall mental well-being.
You know, I was struck by another thing that Joey Patterson said in Carolyn Beeler's report that we just heard. She said, "I don't even know how to begin protecting myself and my life and my livelihoods from what is already starting to happen." So does starting to understand what you call ecological grief, does that seem to help people, giving a name to something?
It certainly does. So back in 2009, the Lancet Commission, which is a major health commission in the world, released a report where they identified climate change as the biggest public health threat of the 21st century. As we move forward, now people are really starting to think, you know, it might actually be mental health related to climate change that's the biggest public health threat. And so starting to have these conversations, starting to find ways to identify it, starting to name it, starting to find opportunities for people who are struggling to deal with the chaos and how to make sense of it, to start to find the language to talk about it, to express it, and also to have it taken seriously at the political level, in education systems, in, you know, public health and professional health practice. What we're grappling with as a humanity at the existential level is really not fully understanding what's actually happening. And I think sort of this idea around how do you even begin to grapple with a chaotic world and make sense is really where many, many people are at. And I think really where, as a species, we're struggling. And what does it mean? So I think when we're trying to tease out what's other forms of mental health versus what's climate and environment related mental health, a lot of them overlap and a lot of them interact and interrelate, and some will magnify and some will actually assist us in building resilience as though they're protective factors. So I think the key is to understand that right now we are living in such a rapid transition, and that rapid transition will always have impacts and effects, and they will be different and they will be inequitable around the globe, but they are something that is going to be increasingly part of what it means to be human and what it means to be alive right now in this period of rapid transition.
Ashley Consolo is director of the Labrador Institute. Thanks a lot, Ashley.
Thanks so much, Carol.
That was The World's Carol Hills talking about ecological grief with Ashley Consolo, a public health researcher at Memorial University in Happy Valley, Goose Bay, Labrador. The Democratic presidential candidates, well, at least 20 of them anyway, will debate this Wednesday and Thursday nights. Tomorrow, here on The World, where they stand on immigration.
When people come because they are fleeing terror in Central America, they fear for their lives, then we have a moral responsibility to listen.
To tell over a billion Muslims in the world that they are not welcome to come into the United States sends a horrible message and something that runs absolutely contrary to American values.
A preview of the Democratic presidential debates. That's tomorrow, right here on the show. Istanbul is celebrating the results of a controversial mayoral election. The opposition party won the first election in March, forced a runoff, and won again in yesterday's voting. The results are seen as a strong rebuke to Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who called for the do-over after his party lost in March. Sinan Ulgun is a former Turkish diplomat and runs a think tank in Istanbul. He says Ekrem İmamoğlu's win in the mayor's race is at the very least a symbolic victory over Erdogan.
Istanbul is Turkey's economic heartland. It is the cultural and business capital of the country and the largest city. This is where, incidentally, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's own political trajectory started when he surprisingly won the race for becoming the mayor of Istanbul back in 1994. And since then, the city has been under the helm of parties that are linked to Erdogan's political heritage. So that is a major shift, which will have some important consequences for the future of Turkey's politics.
I mean, it also seems to be a powerful message for the winner of this runoff election to say that first result back in March was not a fluke. Why do you think Ekrem İmamoğlu inspired people? Like, what was his campaign like?
First of all, he proved to be a very able campaigner. But above all, he did two things remarkably well. One is to consolidate the opposition vote. That's been really a dilemma for the Turkish opposition in the sense that they remain fragmented. And İmamoğlu was very successful in coalescing that support behind him. The second recipe for his success is that he's been able to transcend the now pervasive feature of Turkish politics, populism and identity politics.
So how big of a blow do you think this is to President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his party?
Well, it's certainly the biggest blow of his political career. This is really the first time that he's at the losing end of an election. But this is obviously just a start. Ekrem İmamoğlu needs to deliver as the new mayor of Istanbul in order to consolidate his place as a major political figure in Turkish politics.
Can this change in Istanbul have any effect on relations between Turkey and the United States or any other countries that may have become disillusioned with the strongman politics of the Erdogan era?
Not in the short term, because at the end of the day, Erdogan remains the president of the country under a heavily centralized power system. However, İmamoğlu's win and the wide margin could also introduce a number of changes within the Turkish political system over time, especially if he consolidates his position as a successful local leader. That might, over time, weaken the popularity of the ruling party and open up new scenarios for political change in Turkey.
Are you hopeful by this news of the election of Ekrem İmamoğlu?
Absolutely, I am. This shows that despite its many shortcomings, democracy in Turkey is vibrant. Despite having an unfair playing field, a contender like İmamoğlu can win, and he has won with a record number of votes for the city.
Sinan Ulgen, chairman of the Center for Economics and Foreign Policy Studies in Istanbul. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Finally today, five critically endangered black rhinos wrapped up a pretty historic trip. They were transported from the European zoos where they've been in captivity all the way to Rwanda. The goal is to boost East Africa's black rhino population, which has been depleted by poachers. They arrived in the capital at Kigali International Airport on board a 747 early this morning. And now they're getting to know their new home, Akagera National Park on the eastern edge of Rwanda.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of Akagera National Park.
So this is Jess Gruner. He's the park manager of Akagera. So I gather the 747 that transported these rhinos landed earlier today. Were you on the flight or have you seen the rhinos since they landed?
Yeah, no, I wasn't on the flight, but we were there receiving. We're making sure everything was ready on this end. We only got them out about 3 hours ago. So in the end, it was about a 35-40 hour trip from loading in Europe to coming back to Africa and to coming into their holding areas here in Akagera.
How do they seem after all those hours in the air and now getting transported off the plane into their pens?
Understandably, they're shattered. They're tired. They needed a top-up of some water. It's a stressful venture for anything, let alone just an animal. So they're still just calming down from the sedatives, and we'll see in the morning. It's late in the evening here right now, but we went to check on them, and they're looking actually really, really well.
How endangered is the eastern black rhino species, and what will having five more in Rwanda do to, you know, reestablishing the black rhino population?
Yeah, it's critically endangered. There is about 5,000 black rhinos, but this subspecies, Michaela, which is the eastern black rhino, there's only about 1,000. Their main ranges was Kenya and Tanzania. So to have some in Rwanda is actually fantastic to supplement the 20 we already have. That saying of don't keep all your eggs in one basket is there. You know, now we're another range state and we can contribute to meaningful conservation in East Africa.
Yeah, so these five rhinos, I gather, they have names. Introduce us to who these new five animals are in Rwanda.
Yeah, we have the three that come from Dvor Kralov, Safari Park Dvor Kralov in Czech Republic. Is Yasmina, she's the oldest of them, and she's a female. We have Mani, who's an eight-year-old male, and Yaziri, who's another young female. And then we have one that comes from Flamingoland in the UK called Olomoti, and one from Denmark called Mandela, who's another young male.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to ask you next. They come from Czech Republic, from Denmark, from the UK. I mean, will they do okay in this new home in Rwanda, this new environment?
Yeah, they were all put together as of November last year in the Czech Republic to familiarize themselves with each other. Granted, they are from enclosures in Europe, but, you know, there's proof they rewild very well. And this is going to be a process over time. It's not going to happen overnight. And there are some cases where it's worked so well. So we hope to replicate that and let them breed with our existing population here in the future and really have a good, strong genetic diversity of black rhinos.
So as you said, the adjustment won't happen overnight. But what is your plan, Jess, for these five rhinos when the sun rises tomorrow morning?
It's going to be transition. We've brought a lot of food from what they're used to, and we'll slowly transition them onto natural browse that we have, vegetation we have here. And then in a couple of months, probably put them into larger enclosures of about 1 hectare, and then they go into 100 hectares. And then into actually a 3,000-hectare sanctuary for the next year or two.
Well, good luck to you, Jess, and the rhinos.
Thank you very much.
That's Jess Gruner, the park manager of Akagera National Park in Rwanda, the new home for five eastern black rhinos from Europe. Jess, thanks for your time.
Much appreciated.
Home sweet home. That'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.